This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
We've got a little something for everyone today. Jobs, taxes, fashion, and even some rotisserie chicken to finish out the week. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, January 5th. Good to have you here. It's been an interesting week here in our nation's capital, but we're going to start with the economic news. The job market posted its 87th consecutive month of gains in December, adding 148,000 jobs. That's actually slower growth than we saw most of the year, but the unemployment rate held steady at 4.1%. Joining me to talk about those details and the week gone by is Nela Richardson with Redfin and Sheila Kolhatkar of The New Yorker. How's it going?
Hi, Amy. Going well?
Hey, Amy.
Good to have you here. Nela, let's start with you. So this was the last jobs report for the year that just ended, the first year of the Trump administration. How's it look to you?
It looks pretty good. I mean, this far into the economic expansion, we were averaging last year about 170,000 jobs per month. That's pretty steady growth, pretty steady job creation. But what's missing is that element we've all been waiting for, which is higher wage growth. We've seen a stock market that's been booming, but wages are stagnating. And there's a big disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street still, even though we're very far into a recovery.
Sheila, how about those wages? There was some wage growth, about 2.5% for the year, but workers still aren't seeing enough of a share of that expansion.
Well, this is as Nela mentioned, one of the ongoing mysteries of the economic recovery. You would normally expect when unemployment is so low to see pressure on wages pushing them up, and it just has not happened. Economists have been a bit baffled by this. There are different theories as to why the wage growth has not increased at a greater rate. I mean, automation is one factor. There are even some economists suggesting that the opioid crisis has had some impact on this. But yeah, so we're going to have to really see whether, you know, the president's tax plans have their intended effect and actually lead to higher wages.
That's right. Nela, the tax package just passed and signed is supposed to create more job growth and wage gains as the corporate tax rate gets slashed significantly. Do you expect that to happen? And how long could it take?
The only thing we know for sure about that, Amy, is that it'll create more profits. So we know that the corporate tax rate is going to be slashed. We know that companies are going to make more money. They've been making pretty good money so far last year as well. So the question is, what are they going to do with that extra money? Are they going to give it back to shareholders, or are they going to increase wage worker salaries? So far, the verdict is really still out on that. The tax reform bill does cut the corporate taxes, but it doesn't tell corporations what to do with those proceeds. It's really up to each individual firm to figure out how they're going to invest that cash.
Well, with go ahead, Sheila.
Well, there's just an interesting side note, which is that to follow up on that point, you know, there have been several kind of informal surveys of corporate executives asking them what they think will happen with wages after the companies all see these enormous decreases in their taxes. And almost across the board, the majority of them have said they don't expect that to translate into higher wage growth, which is kind of amazing that they're being so straightforward about that. So
candid. Yeah.
Yeah. But so it's a big question mark.
Well, with taxes out of the way, President Trump is hosting congressional Republicans and cabinet members at Camp David this weekend to talk about future legislative priorities. What do you think is on the agenda? Neela?
That's, again, an open question. You know, the GOP faces a fork in the road. They can pursue bipartisan legislation like infrastructure, or they can go at it alone and start again with Obamacare or cutting entitlement spending. But it's important to note, Amy, that all roads lead to the 2018 midterm elections. So this is going to be a very shrewd calculus about what agenda will get the best payoff for the GOP.
Sheila, infrastructure seems to be one of the possible choices. In some ways, that seems politically easier to tackle than, say, welfare reform. I mean, what do you think they're going to pick?
Well, it's interesting because everyone coming to this meeting has their own pet topic that they want to talk about. And President Trump has indicated that the border wall is his ongoing obsession. And it's going to be interesting to see whether the Republicans, members of Congress, how far they're going to go in trying to kind of give Trump a little bit of what he wants in order to extract some support for their own pet projects, which are not necessarily popular, including, yes, trying to go after welfare, for example, or entitlement programs like Medicaid. So I think it's going to tell us a lot about the dynamic between the president and the Republicans in Congress.
And things have already been pretty dynamic.
Oh, absolutely. Sheila Kolhatkar of The New Yorker, Neela Richardson with Redfin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
On Wall Street today, another record day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As Neela and Sheila and I were talking about at the top of the show, the jobs report revealed some positive signs about the state of the economy. To point out a few longer-term benchmarks, we've had 7 years of steady job growth, one of the longest recoveries on record, and unemployment among African Americans just hit an all-time low of 6.8%. So what's left to worry about? Well, how about the many people who are still out of the workforce altogether? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more on that.
The job market is now better by many measures than it was before the Great Recession. Except labor force participation hasn't fully recovered. That's the percentage of adults currently in the workforce, holding jobs or at least looking for employment. Andrew Stettner at the Century Foundation says it's especially bad for people in their prime working years.
Those Americans that are 25 to 54, less of them are employed than they were in 2006. I calculate there's about 3.5 million missing people in that workforce.
James Pethakoukas at the American Enterprise Institute says a lot of explanations have been floated for why this group has stayed home and might never fully return to the workforce, some of them pretty harsh on the workers themselves.
Whether it's opioids, everyone's playing video games, or it's because there just aren't the kind of good jobs that there used to be.
But he says prime age participation has been rising, and he thinks in time many of these workers will come back into the labor market. Meanwhile, employers are scrambling to deal with a worker pool that's too small to meet rising demand. So they're trying harder to keep the workers they have, says Joe Galvin at Vistage, a business advisory firm.
The other side of hiring is retention of your people. If you're losing your best people and struggling to find new people, that creates a really big challenge, especially for a small or mid-sized business.
In Galvin's most recent survey of businesses, nearly half said they plan to raise wages and or sweeten benefits to attract and retain talent. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
During the next few weeks, we'll be hearing from some of the world's largest companies about big one-time write-downs against their financial results. Think multinationals like Microsoft, Alphabet, and Johnson & Johnson. Many are expected to warn that their profits will be hurt by the huge bills they have to pay to the IRS. It's part of the new tax law. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports, those write-downs are but small setbacks on the way to big windfalls.
For decades, U.S. multinational companies have been hoarding the cash they earn abroad, keeping it offshore so they wouldn't have to pay taxes on it. Well, now, they have to pay.
It doesn't matter whether they bring the profits back or not. Those profits that they previously acquired are taxable.
Eric Toder is at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Under the new tax law, companies have to pay between 8 and 15% on the profits they earned abroad between 1986 and 2017.
That is going to be a lot of money for some companies.
BP just said it's paying $1.5 billion in taxes in the fourth quarter of 2017. Goldman Sachs says it's going to have to pay $5 billion. We're probably going to hear this from a lot more companies in the next quarter or two. So let's all have a moment of silence for the overseas profits of large multinational corporations.
No.
Michaeli Morrow is a tax professor at Suffolk University in Boston.
The tax system is going to be different now.
Multinational companies who've been wanting to bring money home are in for a big payoff.
Anything going forward that's earned in those foreign countries is not going to be subject to U.S. tax.
There is a minimum tax that companies may have to pay, but at the end of the day, companies operating in most countries are not going to owe much, if anything, in U.S. taxes on profits earned abroad. Also, small detail, adds Eric Toder.
The tax rate on domestic profits is going down from 35 to 21%.
So yes, multinational companies are going to pay a big one-time tax, but they're going to get a big tax break for many, many years to come. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
We've been talking about the economy writ large, and now here's a story about one small piece or wing of that economy and why it matters. Raise your hand if rotisserie chicken has been on the menu at your house recently. In the past few decades, the ready-to-eat birds have become a grocery store staple and the go-to dinner option for a lot of Americans. More than half of households have bought prepared chicken in the past year, according to Nielsen. Annie Gasparo wrote about the rotisserie chicken boom in the Wall Street Journal this week and joins me now. Hi, Annie.
Hi.
So how did the rotisserie chicken become sort of the cash cow, so to speak, of the grocery store?
Well, going back to the 90s, when they really first became popular, grocery stores started selling them because they were losing shoppers to Boston Chicken, now Boston Market, the restaurant chain. And since then, their rotisserie chickens have been a real success, more than 600 million sold in the U.S. last year.
And you write 87 million were sold at Costco alone. What is the appeal, do you think?
Well, especially at Costco, they have really held a hard line on pricing and kept them at $4.99 since 2009. And a 3-pound rotisserie fully cooked chicken for $4.99, there's just not much that can beat that. You know, that chicken can easily feed a family, and you can't go to McDonald's and feed a family for under $5.
And grocers are going to pretty great lengths to keep prices down. Costco's even building its own processing plant. Why is that so important, that price point?
The executives I spoke with at Costco and a few other grocers all made it very clear that customers know that price point. There are a few items in the grocery store that everyone knows the price of. They compare prices. You have milk, eggs, bread, and rotisserie chickens. And they're just one of those things that people expect it to be a certain price, and they're very sensitive to it, and they compare with other grocery stores. So, you know, if Costco doesn't want to lose shoppers to Kroger, they have to have a really competitive price and vice versa.
And with so many grocers competing for that business, can you talk about some of the strategies they're using to get people to buy their chicken in particular?
You might notice there are a lot more varieties these days of rotisseries. You can get sriracha flavored, barbecue flavored. You can get all natural, organic, antibiotic free. So you have a lot of innovation on that front. And then at the same time, there's tactics like, you know, where you place the warmers in the store. Some grocery stores are putting them at the very front in the checkout lanes, basically, which is a new thing.
Next to the candy bars?
Yeah, they're hoping that, you know, maybe in addition to a candy bar, you'll buy a chicken.
And part of this is getting people in the store to buy other things that might have higher profit margins, right?
Yes, you see a lot of people buying several side dishes, you know, maybe a bottle of wine and those side dishes, especially if they're prepared foods like mac and cheese or mashed potatoes, they really do have great margins for the grocery stores. And you'll even see some of those side dishes in the warmers with the chickens also to really try to tempt people. And grocery stores are really in need of sales growth. And so these chickens, not only do they drive in traffic and help with the top line sales, but getting the margins from the side dishes is really important to the bottom line.
Annie Gasparo on the chicken beat for the Wall Street Journal today. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up,
the red carpet is really a multi-million dollar business.
Why you'll be seeing a lot of black on top of that red. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 220 points, or 0.8%, to close at 25,295. The NASDAQ climbed 58 points, 0.8%, to finish at 7,136. And the S&P 500 rose 19 points, 0.7%, to end at 2743. For the week, the Dow was up 2.3%, the NASDAQ up 3.4%, and the S&P 500 hopped up 2.6%. More down-and-out news for Sears. The struggling retailer plans to close 103 more Sears and Kmart stores, and shares sank 2.7%. Macy's is closing 11 stores, too. That means a few thousand jobs lost. Macy's stock down less than 0.1%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.47%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. It's no secret that President Trump has a very different energy policy than his predecessor. Yesterday, the administration announced a proposal to dramatically expand offshore oil and gas drilling. Another opening for drillers under this White House, the delay of a requirement that companies disclose payments they make to foreign governments. The rule is meant to prevent bribery and corruption, but now it may not just be delayed. Republicans in Congress are trying to repeal this section of the law entirely. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Lots of natural resources, diamonds, oil, iron ore, are buried in countries with histories of corruption, places where bureaucrats have, say, demanded bribes in exchange for oil contracts. The mining and drilling sector is the most corrupt in the world, according to a study by the Intergovernmental Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. So to fight this, the U.S. Congress passed a bill in 2010 requiring oil and gas companies listed on Wall Street to publish all payments to governments. The idea? To deter companies from dirty business, says Barnaby Pace of the anti-corruption group Global Witness.
Fundamentally, it helps protect them and prevent demands for bribes when they can say, well, look, we can't pay a bribe. If we did, this would be entirely obvious because we'll have to disclose the figures at the end of the year.
But before the rules kicked in last year, Congress and President Trump took measures to stop them. Now there's at least a year-long delay, plus a separate effort to repeal them altogether. Why? U.S. industry argues that disclosure puts them at a competitive disadvantage to foreign drillers that don't have to tell this info. Harvard business professor George Serafim puts the argument this way.
If they disclose some of that information can be used by some of their competitors to offer, for example, better contracts to governments and take some of those assets.
The American Petroleum Institute backs up this argument of disadvantage, and the Trump administration says mandatory disclosure costs too much for oil companies. But Barnaby Pace at Global Witness says 70% of the biggest oil companies in the world disclose their payments with no problem. And he says corruption is still a huge issue worth fighting. One big case? Shell Oil and the Italian state-owned company Eni will soon go on trial in what he calls the biggest corporate bribery case ever. The allegation? Bribing Nigerian officials with up to $1 billion.
Some of the executives facing a trial today were told that the $1 billion they were paying for this one of Nigeria's most valuable offshore oil blocks was likely to find its way into a vast bribery scheme.
The missing billion was supposed to go to the Nigerian people. That amount is exactly the country's annual health budget. and exactly how much the government wanted to spend fighting the extremist group Boko Haram, says Edwin Okoria in Nigeria. He's an advocate for the anti-poverty group One.org, and he says Boko Haram's attacks drove 2 million people out of their homes.
This is like the population of a whole country that is displaced, that needs to be fed, needs to be housed, and that could have been taken care of if there was enough money for logistics, enough money for arms, money for equipment. Lives are lost.
When a country is rich in commodities but its people are poor, this is often called the resource curse. Ikoria says the U.S. led the global fight against this curse when it passed the disclosure law in 2010. Canada and the EU followed Washington's example, and now, he says, Washington's going the other way.
When you on one breath talk about democracy and the rule of law and transparency, and then on the other hand, in the name of protecting companies, you back out of international transparency initiatives, it just smacks hypocrisy.
The U.S. has just pulled out of another initiative for companies around the world to volunteer information on the money they pay to governments. It's called the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative. And Jonas Moberg heads the international office in Norway.
And more companies, oil and gas companies, big ones, have started to make this sort of information available, saying, you know what, whether it's we're forced by the SEC, we ought to actually just make it public.
Even Russian and Chinese companies disclose more information than American firms do. That's according to numbers run by Global Witness. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The Golden Globes are this Sunday, and there may be even more focus than usual on how movie stars and other celebrities are dressed. Many are expected to wear black to the awards show in solidarity with victims of sexual harassment and abuse, and to promote a new campaign for gender equity in Hollywood and beyond called Time's Up. The initiative launched this week with more than 300 prominent female actors, writers, and entertainment executives, and it includes a legal defense fund for victims of sexual misconduct. Booth Moore is style and fashion news director at The Hollywood Reporter. Hi there.
Hi.
So how much black should we be expecting to see this weekend?
I think it's going to be a near blackout. Most every
wow.
actress in Hollywood, I think, is going to be participating in this statement.
And you've written that it kind of changed the market for fashion this time around. Talk about the deal making that typically goes on before an award ceremony.
Well, the red carpet is really a multi-million dollar business, and lots of celebrities get paid to wear gowns, or they get paid as part of deals that they have with brands to appear in their advertisements, etc. And there's also deal making around jewelry brands, and we're talking fees that can run into the six figures that actresses can get to wear diamond sparklers from the likes of Tiffany, De Beers, and Louis Vuitton.
They don't just get to wear this stuff. They actually get paid to do it.
They do occasionally get paid to do it. Yeah, it's definitely not every single person, but it is, can be quite lucrative as a revenue stream for actors and their management teams. But what we're seeing this season to start to happen is that we're seeing a couple of brands already who are offering to donate to the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. Sachin and Bobby is one out of New York, and Prabal Gurung is another. And then some actresses like Shailene Woodley, who are only wanting to work with partners who are agreeing to donate to the fund.
How much money are we talking about here? Do you have any sense of what this could be worth to the Time's Up campaign?
Well, if the big jewelry brands get on board, those deals are the most lucrative and are in the, can be $500,000, $750,000. But the designers who are donating are smaller businesses. Prabal Gurung and Sachin and Bobby are both independent. So I would think that those would be in the tens of thousands of dollars.
Of course, the Golden Globes are just the beginning of the awards season. Do you expect the trend to continue to the Oscars and other shows?
I don't think we're going to see a blackout continue to the other award shows. In fact, I've heard that some people are actually going to be wearing the dresses that they, you know, the colorful dresses that they may have worn to the Golden Globes to later award shows. But I do think we're going to continue to see this trend of using the red carpet as a platform for good, because it really follows in the greater consumer trend of conscientious spending. You know, in the last year, we've seen people sort of protest with their dollars. And I think that this is an indication that Hollywood wants to make sure that their money is going to the best place as well.
Booth Moore, she wrote about the Golden Globes fashion blackout for The Hollywood Reporter. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This final note, they're calling it the latte levy. A parliamentary committee in Britain is recommending a 34-cent tax on paper coffee cups. Apparently, the plastic lining inside those cups makes them tough to recycle, meaning most of the 2.5 billion disposable coffee cups the UK tosses each year pile up in landfills. Lawmakers are hoping a penalty will help. Even when coffee shops offer a discount if you bring your own reusable cup, only 1 or 2% of customers actually do so. That's it. We got to run. Today, the Dow jumped 220 points, 0.8%. The NASDAQ climbed 58 points, 0.8%. And the S&P 500 rose 19 points, or 0.7%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fergali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Amy Scott. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.